Welcome to the Upriser podcast. I'm your host, Clinton Bonner. Upriser focuses on technology conversations centered in the future of work and how new technologies are applied and how work evolves. The Upriser podcast is brought to you by Topcoder. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Upriser podcast brought to you by Topcoder. I'm with a very special guest today. I'm excited to talk to him. I've known this gentleman for a couple of years now. We've run in similar circles in the world of open innovation and crowdsourcing. But I've got Gavin McLafferty, who is the founder of 1981 Ventures, which focuses an innovation consultancy focusing on solving some of the world's biggest challenges through open talent, through crowdsourcing, through open innovation. And he's got a lot of really cool enterprise experience that we're going to dive into today as well. Gavin, how you doing, man? Can you let the good people of Earth know, where do you reside? What drives you? Where are you sitting today? And overall, how you doing, man?
Thanks so much for having me, Clinton. It's an absolute pleasure to be able to catch up and to share some of my story. I'm really driven by solving complex problems, navigating through ambiguity, and that's something which we have an abundance of at this moment in time. There's so many difficult things happening in the world, and I'm really passionate about navigating a path through that. Been involved in the open innovation world now for 5 years through Subsea 7, and have been leading a global program with them for some time. Have a quite an extensive track record there. I've led 9 open innovation challenges to the market, 10 confidential technology search projects, and 6 internal challenges across my organization. It's been a pretty phenomenal experience. I've been really lucky to connect with people like yourself and some of the world's most innovative companies. I've led an organization from a blank canvas, and I've developed an ecosystem where I'm pretty confident that almost any problem can be solved and unimaginable levels of intelligence can be reached.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly one of our philosophies at Topcoder. You know, and the old classic open innovation philosophy that the best talent doesn't sit inside your four walls. And as of today in 2020, what the heck are four walls anyway, right? So that reality is crashed on our doorstep, and those that were kind of ready for the change were able to be a much more resilient enterprise and kind of keep on going, if not even improve how they produce. And others kind of got, you know, wally lumped, if you will. I think I'm using that term correctly, but you know, by a rogue wave that was the pandemic, right? And really threw people into a different way. What I think would be interesting for folks to understand is, you know, when I first started talking with you probably about maybe 2.5 years ago now, something like that, right? Yeah. Maybe 3 years ago. I didn't know what Subsea 7 was. You know, it's to me, it was one of those, yeah. I follow like, you know, I follow finance quite a bit. So I'm very active in the market. So, you know, for me on the background, there's always like CNBC, Fox Business, Bloomberg. I'm going through all those. I'm digesting stuff. And it's still, even for someone like me that kind of pays attention, I'm always shocked when like, another multi-billion-dollar company is like, I never heard of them. I don't even know what they do. And then upon understanding them a bit, I'm like, damn, that's a cool business. And that's a cool that's another one that just I did not know they were even there. So I think folks would be would benefit from knowing what Subsea 7 is, what they do, and then we can maybe go down that awesome list of those types of challenges you ran and maybe get into some of the idiosyncrasies of what's different from, you know, the 9 challenges versus the 10 searches and what are the nuances there? Because I think there's a lot to learn for folks who are super interested in using open talent for the enterprise like you have. So let's start there, man. Subsea 7, if we had to get the condensed version, what is it and you know, what do you do there, by the way?
Yeah, okay. So essentially Subsea 7 is an engineering construction firm which provides project management services to the oil and gas and renewables market. So they provide services to a wide range of oil and gas operators, from very large organizations like BP and Shell right through to smaller organizations, for example, like Wintershall, and Primer Oil, who are all amazing. They work across the world, so they work in many countries, over 30 countries. They operate a fleet of vessels, so they have vessels which execute different projects, and they have around 12,000 people globally. So they work in amazing places like St. John's in Newfoundland in Canada, right through to Houston and Gulf of Mexico, Rio de Janeiro, and across the sea in Western Africa, United Kingdom, France, they operate there and from Paris, and they operate operations throughout Norway, cross into the Middle East, and then some amazing operations being executed from Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, and then Perth, Australia. They're an organization that work across a variety of different markets. So some of those are known as SURF markets, which are subsea, umbilicals, risers, and flow lines. And they have other markets, which are around installation, repair, and maintenance, and renewables, and heavy lifting. So I'm just going to take a second and dive into those a little bit. It's an industry which is surrounded by acronyms, but they have some really cool things happening. So they, for example, will have a client that will come forward to them and say, I've got, you know, this amazing oil and gas field. I'd like to develop it. And they will work with that client to design the optimal pipeline setup. They will then create a pipeline which takes that from the seabed to the shore.
Wow.
And they will install and carry out all the work, you know, using a variety of different people, a variety of different technologies. And essentially, they will install that from a vessel. Or they may use remotely operated vehicles at different times, depending on the water depth. And once that amazing infrastructure is installed, they will also cater to service that right through from its installation right through to its decommissioning. They have an amazing business called iTech Services, which caters for the installation, repair, and maintenance part of the industry. And they can go in and they can operate these autonomous vehicles at hundreds of meters of water depth and execute the most amazing tasks. So it's pretty phenomenal. And over the last few years, they've got very heavily into the renewables sector. And recently, they have finished an amazing project on the west of Scotland, which is actually the largest wind farm in the UK at that time, called the Beatrice Project, which is absolutely phenomenal.
That's awesome. I've watched enough British Opens to understand that there's some wind out there.
Yeah, there's some serious wind. So we're blessed with some pretty amazing weather over here, and can generate a lot of power and energy.
Awesome. No, that's very cool. So, you know, you definitely laid out a lot of cool places we can go and discuss. The one that kind of first comes up for me is just that you mentioned the global presence and like all the different places in which, you know, that subsea is operating. And then for you in the OI lead there for the last 5 years, have you gotten to also travel to some of these spots and go to some of these sites, and what's that been like for you?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been fortunate to see a huge amount of the world. I've done a lot of traveling inside and outside of work. And certainly in the past few years, I've spent a lot of time traveling to Houston. I've been in Rio de Janeiro. I've been over in St. John's. I've met, you know, so many amazing different people and experienced different cultures. And it's great to see what's happening in these different places and how people solve problems and draw insights. And one thing that we kind of found ourselves within was around kind of 5 years ago, the oil and gas market experienced a profound downturn. And there was a need for us, for the organization, to think fundamentally different, to move way beyond business improvement. Mm-hmm. And there was a need for the organization to think, okay, well, if we want to embrace this philosophy where we're looking at moonshot thinking and we say, okay, we're interested in 10x improvements, not 10%. Mm-hmm. And most organizations can, you know, improve things by a few percent here and there. But as you know, if you want to make a magnitude of improvement, it requires a fundamentally different mindset. So we started working with the University of Cambridge And we took a way of working, which was developed by someone called Gene Slowinski, which is called Want, Find, Get, Manage. And that allows you to articulate the challenge that you're trying to solve. So what do you want to do? Then you can define, okay, where might I find a solution? Do I even know? And then once you get that solution, how do you manage that? Because working with startups or ecosystems is different to working with large multinational corporations. And we started to really quite quickly be able to frame these different types of challenges that we had and take them beyond our own organization. So beyond our supply chain and access the outside world. And we started to engage with some other intermediaries. So organizations like Nine Sigma and Yet Too, and we got back some phenomenal results. Items that would allow us to make game-changing progress in a matter of weeks, rather than wait, you know, years or longer to make that level of progress internally.
Yeah, that's very impressive. And I think, you know, you talk about moonshots and a 10x versus a 10%. I mean, I think most corporations have gotten very good at incremental innovation and also whatever sharpening there is when it comes to margins and costs. And they've gotten extremely good at that. And then there's the other side of it, which is truly a business model reinvention. Like you said, you hit a crisis and are you able to, or you could preempt a crisis better yet. And you're able to make a leap to some near field or even out of field that you weren't there, but use the learnings of where you were and then outside external talent to help you get there. I do want to stick with the culture pretty quickly, because I think it's a cool question. So you travel the world, you're doing all these different projects, and, you know, being the open innovation lead, are there pockets of the world that you saw that were more open to the concepts of external influence or external talent to help propel projects versus other pockets that might be more, I don't call them conservative or traditional, just more, well, I guess more just locked into, well, we have the SMEs, we have the experts, and we don't need a hesitance to open things up to external brains. Was there a difference when you traveled across the globe for some of these projects?
Absolutely. So I was really kind of fortunate to begin with. And there was a number of people who were kind of resistant with that level of change and engaging with organizations outside of our industry or outside of our kind of supply chain. And there was real consideration and real concern around, are we potentially sharing information that's commercially sensitive? Are we engaging with organizations which could compromise our competitive advantage? And thankfully, I had a really strong sponsor. So the vice president that I was working with at the time, Phil Simons, was an absolutely amazing person, and still is a sponsor for the program. And he gave me the opportunity to work with some really interesting people in the business. But you know, there was these amazing challenges that we were able to surface. And what we tried to do was secure sponsors for those, but also, you know, take some of the people who are more resistant towards doing this and work with them and show them some of the benefits. So there were parts of the business that were very traditional, and they were more resistant towards changing. And when they were able to see that we could, you know, augment some of our research and development and make breakthrough progress in a matter of weeks, then they started to line up to come into this and get involved. And that was really, really amazing.
And we see that, you know, that's a very consistent story for us too. Our experiences at Topcoder is that very often some of the more resilient folks end up becoming some of the top champions. And it's, I don't think that's unnatural. I think it follows suit that they are smart. They do have a lot of expertise. And once they realize that, I think the big realization, the aha for, I think, individuals and maybe groups within larger companies that are using open talent, using crowd, is that once they understand that this is not a threat to their full-time employment livelihood, like whatsoever, and if it's set culturally in the right way, that, wait a second, this is not a replacement. this is yet another tool that I should be using in a strategy to accomplish my job, to accomplish my goals, and in your case, to do the biggest things, which is to, you know, drive breakthrough innovations that have that 10x, you know, movement with them, which is really cool. And for us at TopCoder, we see that, you know, down on like software project levels, because that's what we do. You know, we're doing software, but I don't think it's just like just a software thing or just an engineering thing. I really think it's horizontal across pretty much every industry I've seen. Absolutely. But you get these SMEs, and once they realize that this is a thing they can use to propel not only their career, but how much they're able to achieve and like how they can progress with it, a light switch goes on, and they become early adopters, and then they very quickly become the biggest advocates and the folks who will carry the torch and say, no, you've got to see this, you've got to try this. I didn't believe it either. And yet we're here, right? And it's pretty cool. Did you have any folks that like kind of came along that same path for you that were maybe early detractors, but then ended up becoming advocates within Subsea?
Yeah, so there was a part of our business that was very nervous about us running this approach by using an open innovation approach. And they kind of took me aside privately and said, look, are you sure about this? Because this could be risky. And I kind of explained to them, and I was like, look, there are some amazing opportunities if we use this tool set. And the toolkit that we developed will allow you to access information or to engage with people on a public basis, or to do that in a way where we run technology search projects, which protect our commercial interests, and we gather these insights into the future. And we worked with that part of the business very successfully to unlock a whole bunch of different challenges. They actually came forward, and we worked on a number of challenges which were public. So we looked at challenges around understanding inspection and pipelines, being able to process data faster, to be able to understand the types of technologies which could provide really detailed scans of pipelines without having any downtime for clients, without having to open up the pipelines, and then provide that information back in real time. And the reality was that when we ran these challenges, two things happened. We solved the problem, and the second thing was that we solved other problems that we hadn't yet thought of. So we solved things for the future, which were going to be beneficial for future projects, which were pretty amazing. And then there was also obviously a level where people kind of sat back and said, okay, wow, we had no idea that, you know, that this was quite possible. And, you know, we need to educate ourselves about our future roadmaps and make a, you know, and take a decision where it's either make or buy. You know, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to be able to accelerate and offer, you know, significant value to our clients and move forward.
Yeah, it's an impressive progression, and you know, we see it as well. Once, like I said, the light bulb goes on, or the aha moment when they see how it can be used and that it can be trusted. That to me is the biggest thing. I talk about trust a lot. That you know, we have this work from home shift, and then what will, in my opinion, happen next is there'll be some bounce back to offices, but there'll be more work from home. I don't like to talk in the big hyperbolic states, you know, and oh, it's the office is dead and all that stuff. I work from home, and right now I miss my business trips. I want to go see my team. I want to go see customers. I can't wait to get back on a plane, and that's not because of a home life situation. I have a good home life situation, but I'm a human, and I want to see people that are curious and that we create with. And I think the next wave is platforms where people have trust in those platforms, that they know they will repeatedly serve up good talent, and then through that talent, you know, high quality outcomes. I think the interesting piece you talked about earlier is that it always comes back to, or at least very often it comes back to, especially in an early engagement with what could be naysayers and detractors, is that idea of the risk around IP, the risk around enterprise, you know, enterprise sharing something maybe they ought not to be sharing. And yeah, I always like to invert that and discuss the risk of not innovating, the risk of going too slow, the risk of being lapped by someone who doesn't have the same constraints on or blinders on that you have. And I think that's an interesting piece to to dive into a little bit as well. And any lessons there from you, like, you know, they bring this objection to you, and how do you overcome it? What's the step to get them on board?
Yeah. So, I guess like this might sound a little bit non-conformist. But a few people have kind of asked me those kind of questions in my organization.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've kind of flipped that around and then said, well, what's the cost of doing nothing? What's the cost if you don't innovate? You know, do you want to be in a situation where you lose market share or you cease to exist? And if you look at like the Standard & Poor's 500 index, they did a study on this in detail, and they looked at the average tenure of companies and the lifespan of organizations, and it has changed significantly over the last 20 years. And I would guarantee that whatever research is published at the end of this year is going to show that companies need to adapt very quickly or fall behind. One of the best books that I read in the last sort of 5 years was Peter Thiel and Blake Masters' book From Zero to One. And in there, Peter Thiel offers some advice, and he says, the greatest risk you can take is to take no risk at all. So in other words, stand still and be prepared for your competition to come in and eat your lunch for you. And there was something that kind of really resonated with me, and that was from Wayne Gretzky. And he said in the early 90s, and someone asked him, what's the best advice you ever received? And he said, well, my coach was always telling me that you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And that kind of stuck with me. So what I did was I worked with, you know, a whole bunch of different parts of the company. And, you know, some would be kind of a little bit resistant and say, okay, well, now's not quite the right time. We are definitely interested, but kind of circle back later. Mm-hmm. And I would say, okay, that's fine. I've got plenty of work to do right now, and I'll work with these folks over at the site here. And I would work with them. And then what I would do is I'd report back to these other people and say, look at what we've just achieved, what we've achieved in the space of 12 weeks. You know, this in effect is on par with more than 2 years worth of work. And by the way, we've unlocked this huge project for a client. This is worth, you know, a deep work project to us with, you know, huge, huge return on investment for us with very small amounts of money, but, you know, huge levels of magnitude. And that started to get people really excited. And they're like, okay, so this isn't going to impact on, you know, the roles that we have, or it's not going to take anything away from us. And I said, no, it has the opposite effect. It augments your capability. It frees you up to do the things that are value adding, where you know that you need to be involved. And it allows you to rapidly move forward and then to say, okay, where can we make the most impact for our clients? Where can we make the most impact for our organization? And, you know, there was a recognition for me that you know, a lot of organizations say that people are their most important asset. And I believe organizations that say that. But I think we've entered an age where time is our most precious currency. And if you can accelerate things and you can make things happen, you know, you can't get back time. But if you can achieve magnitudes of improvement within short periods of time, then people get very excited, and that creates a lot of value for the people who are involved, but also the organization.
Yeah, and I think a couple things come up for me on that part. But to stick with that point, first is, you know, we see at TopCoder, we see the same thing where folks who might have been worried about like I said, their livelihood or their FTE, their full-time position. The folks who embrace, it doesn't have to be just TopCoder, the folks who embrace open as a philosophy and use it in different parts of how they get work done, those are the folks who very often they get promoted. And I don't know, I don't think this is irony, but maybe from their first mental state it is, but they actually grow their teams. Their budgets grow and their teams grow. Because just, you know, comparing apples to apples when it gets juxtaposed versus traditional work happening within four walls, just more getting done. Because it's that when you condense and collapse your time frames to get to high quality outcomes, well, then guess what? You could do the next one. You know, you could add on or add features or innovate on top of what you just did. Whereas the traditional way, you know, maybe you're not even out of the starting blocks quite yet, or you're only halfway through a POC versus you're ready to market. You know, you've got an MVP out to market. Now you're tinkering with another feature, another thing that's going to add to it. And I do want to harken back to, you brought up the great Gretzky quote. I'm a big hockey guy. Grew up on Long Island, so I'm a New York Islander fan. I was young. I'm 42 now, so I was young when the Islanders had their dynasty, the four in a row, beating the Edmonton Oilers, I might add, by sweeping them in their last cup. But when you talk about Gretzky, I do think of Michael Scott in The Office with his beautiful quote of Wayne Gretzky, and then of course with Michael Scott, you know, co-opting Wayne Gretzky's fantastic, 100% of the shots you don't take don't go in. But I think that's the mentality. And I think also maybe we can talk a bit about the challenges you ran, and maybe in this light, we talk about taking shots, and if you don't take your shots, they don't go in. Beyond collapsing timelines, one of the biggest benefits that I see in an open innovation or crowdsourcing philosophy is that you actually get more shots on net. Just, you know, you get a higher volume. So even if your percentage of wins stays exactly the same from traditional innovation practices, however, you've increased your volume by, again, that number 10x, well then guess what? You've also increased your successes by that same X, because that's just math. In your world, has that held true as well too? So it's not just the fear of not taking shots, but it's the, hey, we put more shots on net. We're gonna light the light a couple more times than normal.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, the first kind of round of challenges that we ran were around pipeline products, and one was around quite a technical challenge, but essentially it was around a clamp that existed within a pipeline and how that structure could be optimized. And that clamp held together a variety of other pipelines within this pipeline. And so we released it to the market, worked with Nine Sigma. They did a great job. And we got back a whole variety of different proposals. And what was really interesting was each of them provided different perspectives. And we worked with several of these solution providers. But there was one that really stood out. And the funny thing was that the proposal came from someone that worked for a local university just a matter of miles away from our office. And a lecturer reached out with a proposal, and he said, "I've worked in the aerospace industry. I have a lot of experience in topology optimization and finite element analysis of structures. I've used this really successfully in other industries, and I believe that I can optimize your structure for you." And we said, "This sounds amazing. We would love to hear more about this." So we brought him in and we had a discussion. And essentially what he said was, "I've said in my proposal, I believe I can reach somewhere around a 15% optimization of the structure." And he said, "I believe I can come in and help your team and train them how to use this methodology." And he discussed with them some of the software that they were using, the time frames that they use, and he collapsed that. And then he said, "Okay, I'm going to come in and train you." And he did that. And then at the end of this small amount of time, he said, "I was a little conservative with my analysis. The material saving that I've been able to create is over 25%. And by the way, you know, I can save this amount of time and this amount of dollars. And if you use your existing software, if you plug in this additional module, then this will automate the process for you." And I remember thinking in my mind, we probably should have this man on retainer. It's just incredible.
Yeah, there's so many so many truisms that come up for me there when it comes to when people talk about why open in the first place. And just with that story, the first one is kind of going back to the Gretzky quote is, you open the net wider by casting a challenge. Now, it just so happened you found, you know, you found a fella, you know, a stone throw away that you could go have a pint with. Maybe there was some benefit when it came time to meet that person. Although getting on a plane most times is not a big deal nowadays. However, you probably wouldn't have come across that person in the first place without the casting, right? So you get that shot on goal that way because you put out the challenge and you're open to it because you take that shot. The second one that we hear a lot is the idea of near field innovation. Someone has done something previously in a field that's similar, or maybe not, but there's some shared aspects of what's being attempted to be solved, and they can take their knowledge and reapply it to a field where, in your world, your subject matter experts, I know for a fact, they're darn smart people. They know their stuff. These engineers are, I'm sure, they're top people, and they are quite bright. However, if you grow up in the world, this is not a subsea thing, but for this example, if you grow up in the subsea culture and environment and world, and you're always focusing on your problems, then you naturally have blinders on. You don't think, you know, not to be cliche, but you don't think about outside the box solutions that could solve something for you. Yet somebody down the street who has this near field experience could say, wait a second, I've solved something like this before. It's going to need a little tweaking. Don't get me wrong. It's not going to fit, you know, straight away. However, I can apply this and I think I'm going to have good success. So those are kind of two truisms, I'd say, of open innovation philosophy in general. I think it's a really cool example. And I did want to ask too, so you talked about earlier, and I did want to circle back to it. You know, you had kind of like 9 open challenges, 10 searches, and 6 internal. Can you give a little bit of detail, at least to say maybe why some stay the way they are? And like when you're doing an open challenge, what are you really looking for versus when you're doing a search, what's the output you're looking for from an organizational standpoint?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, typically when we run an open challenge to the market, these are items that we're looking for new perspectives on, or, you know, areas that we may have considered in the past but dismissed, but, you know, these may be valid now. There's maybe other reasons why this should be considered again, or that there may be areas that we are just not aware of. You know, we've got 12,000 great people working for us, but, you know, we live in a world of 7.8 billion people. So it's human nature that there may be something else out there that we're not aware of. In terms of the kind of technology search work that we do, so these are typically topics that are deeply confidential or commercially sensitive. And the reason that we use that approach is that there may be something that we need to acquire that we know could unlock a project for us in the future, or we may wish to get, you know, an in-depth insight into how technology is progressing across industries over a particular time frame. And, you know, we might want to say, okay, what's the short, medium, and long-term horizon on that project or on that product? And that's very useful. And it's helped us enormously. There has been several, you know, of these. There's been 10 of these technology searches that we've done with a variety of providers. But there's been one that really kind of stood out, and I presented some work on that in Copenhagen last year with Yet2. And that was around a piece of subsea architecture. And we were able to find three really incredible solutions to this particular challenge. And, you know, they presented a vast amount of value for our organization. In terms of the internal challenges that we've run, so typically these have been around a wide variety of topics. So some of these have been around, for example, us looking to optimize existing processes and gathering collective intelligence on those, you know, how can we be more competitive or you know, how can we drive improvements in X, Y, or Z process? And then we've also asked about, you know, more blue sky thinking themes. So we've collaborated with different crowds of people within our organization. And in kind of late 2018, we ran a really interesting campaign, which was a hybrid campaign, where we collaborated with some of our external colleagues within Norway, UK, and Canada, and the Norwegian Shipowners Association, where we collaborated on a topic around ocean plastics. And it's a topic that affects everybody in the world. Mm-hmm. But we said, okay, look, we have all these amazing vessels operating across the world. How can we play a key part in this? How can we contribute something meaningful to society and help reduce this and help create a circular economy? And we got back some phenomenal ideas from our colleagues.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and more recently, we've had some really interesting campaigns where we've reached out to different teams within the business, and we've said, okay, look, here's a topic that we want to work on, a sensitive. We want to look at these focus areas for the next year. What does this look like to you? What do you think? And gather up people's thoughts on it. So really kind of testing and validation of what would work. And then we've had other campaigns that have been more around, feedback and engagement, where we've said, to the whole business, how do we solve this particular problem? What's out there? And it's generated a vast amount of interest, where we've had huge, huge numbers of organizations engage.
Yeah, I think there's the lesson there for me, and I think for listeners too, is there's more than one way to do this. In fact, there's obviously several, but they have different benefits. Besides getting to outputs, getting to better outputs and getting there faster, there's also, you just talked a lot about what I would just put into a bucket of employee engagement. Employees feeling like they have ownership and they have a voice in how this might come to be. And, if you talk to the human capital leaders out there and the CHROs, of course, that golden goose is always, it's that engagement level. Like how happy, how engaged are these people with their work? And I think there's plenty of studies to say, as engagement goes up, so does productivity, so do outputs. And also the chances of them attriting, I think, go down because they like what they're doing and they're fulfilled from their job in that way, that they're doing curious work, that their company, again, back to the keyword, the company trusts them to have an opinion there, and the mechanisms are there to be a vestibule to basically transfer that knowledge in a way that is transparent and in a way where they feel like they've got a voice. And it's such a key pillar, I think, going forward, as companies, I believe, are going to look more and more for like an all-in strategy of I want talent from every single way I could possibly get it, and they'll figure out how to partition that talent into work as work is divvied out. And then part of that is giving the employees their ability to use that talent to have their voice as well. I think it's a really bright future for productivity in general. And Gavin, I need to pat myself on the back. We've gone a full 45 minutes and I've yet to mention your Homer J. Simpson skateboard that's been screaming at me from the moment we turned on our cameras. See a couple of cool boards back there. So from a personal level, I'm assuming you don't just collect them as artwork, but do you have an affinity for boarding?
Yes, and other sports? Yes. I used to be sponsored to skateboard and to snowboard when I was younger.
Nice.
Before my knee was destroyed. And it was a lot of fun, and it's something I'm still very passionate about.
Nice. Do you have any particular, like, if you were out there as a sponsored pro, were there any people that you kind of gravitated towards, were saying, like, I mean, obviously everybody knows Tony Hawk. Beyond the Tony Hawks of the world, who else was out there that you were like, whoa, this person was just so legit and so much fun and so innovative out there that you always wanted to kind of be seen or be around or try to get up to that person's level?
Yeah, so there's so many amazing people out there, but there was a local person from Aberdeen called John Rattray. He absolutely blazed a trail in terms of his skateboarding career, and he was sponsored by some of the world's leading skateboard firms and made a very successful career for himself out in the United States. And he's now kind of semi-retired and works for Nike.
Nice.
There's so many others that are just incredible on all levels.
Cool. No, it's a fun thing. We were talking before we hopped on. My son just got his first real skateboard yesterday, so he's out there jamming now. 2 days ago, he busted his chin and had to get 4 stitches on a scooter accident. But don't tell the docs. But he's out there now. he's out there. He's going to skateboard. So he's getting right back up, which is a cool thing. But Gavin, so, you have 1981 Ventures, it's a consultancy that people can tap this knowledge that you've now developed over these years of experience. Folks out there that might be listening or watching, what's the best way for them to find you, hit you up and say, hey, I might have a project or two to discuss with you?
Yeah, just lean into me on LinkedIn, or I have a website, 1981ventures.com. You know, I think a lot of the things that are going on in the world are quite disruptive at the moment, and people are just looking for answers and insights. And, you know, there's a way to do that, a way that those can be accelerated. You know, I've been really, really fortunate to see a lot of the world and get a chance to work across many different industries and be able to reach out and hang out with people like Clinton and the guys at Topcoder, and so many other people. But, you know, something always kind of resonates with me, and it's what the French writer Proust said, you know, a long, long time ago. And he said, the real voyage of discovery consists not in seeking new landscapes, but in having new eyes. Being able to gather perspectives and being able to accelerate is something that's so important right now. You know, the firm that I'm building is going to focus on two key things. And one is how you can make your organization agile from a strategic point of view, but also, you know, how do you create a human level of agility where your organization can not only scale to meet the market, but how can you access the best talent possible?
I love it. Those are some things that the team and I at Topcoder are always thinking about, because the world of agile and the world of cloud, they really set the base, architecturally speaking, to then look at how do we use human capital in the most efficient and most rewarding way. You know, rewarding to the talent, efficient for the enterprise, and where the outputs and the outcomes are really strong. And that layer of agile mindset, you know, consistent, continuous feedback, and then, of course, cloud infrastructure that makes this all possible just from a pure computing standpoint. It's a lot of these things come together. Then you add in the work from home movement, which, by the way, was a movement before the movement. It was already happening. People wanted more work from home. There's tons of great studies out there that we've shared recently that we're just showing the trends. And now, of course, yes, it's accelerated, but you put all these things into a pot and you say, wow, this is a very exceptional time that if you're focused on transformation and you really want to understand how can an enterprise the next 20, 30 years wholly have a different talent strategy, this is the time to make those moves. And you could get there pretty darn quickly. So I hope folks that are listening, they do dial you up to get into your brain and get you involved, because I know you can help them. And thanks for coming on the Upriser podcast too, and just sharing these stories. And there's not that many people yet across the globe who have had the experiences that you've had, that have done this for, you know, 5-6 years, where it's like you've seen these successes. So getting these stories told, I think, is such a key to getting the awareness to where it has to be, so that people could take that next step and say, okay, I'm aware of it now. I really do buy in, this could help me. And now I've got to take that next step towards activating it for my company and my enterprise. And I think that's the next wave we're already seeing, which is really cool. So, hey, Gavin, man, thank you so much. Really a pleasure to chat with you. Have a great rest of the week. And I'll see you on some calls and some things in the future too, man. But be great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Clinton, for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure to connect with you and your audience, and a pleasure to connect with Topcoder and Upriser. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Bye. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to the Upriser podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, so it's pretty easy. And of course, I encourage you to follow us out on social at Upriser, UPRISOR, on Twitter. And also, I would encourage you to follow Topcoder at Topcoder, TOPCODER.